Good morning. At the end of last year, I was putting together this year's preaching calendar, as I do each year, and I made the decision to fill this season, this long stretch of the church year from Pentecost to Advent, with three books: Chronicles, Ezra, and Nehemiah. Now, there's a clear chronological sense to this order, right? It like makes sense. Chronicles tells the story of Israel from its first king, King Saul, to its last king, Zedekiah. And at the end of Chronicles, the kingdom has fallen. The people have been forcefully removed from the land. There's no temple, there's no king. Jerusalem has been plundered and flattened. But the final words of the book of Chronicles offers this sliver of hope. The last paragraph jumps ahead 70 years when God announces Israel's release. And that's where the books of Ezra and Nehemiah pick up the story. God's people are set free from their slavery to Babylon. They're free to return to the land, to rebuild their homes and their lives and the temple and the walls of Jerusalem. Following the story in this way, then, makes perfect sense to us. This is how we usually tell our stories, right? From beginning to end. It's why our Bibles order the books in this way, from Chronicles to Nehemiah. But what if I told you that there is another way to tell this story? And that if you tell the story in a different way, in a different order, the story can actually have an altogether different impact on you. Well, before Christians created what we know of as our sort of standard order for the books in the Bible, there was a Jewish order for the scriptures that was actually pretty different from what we find in our Bibles. In their collection, Ezra and Nehemiah don't follow Chronicles. They actually come right before Chronicles. And whereas Ezra, Nehemiah, and Chronicles are tucked right into the middle of our First Testament, see, in the Jewish ordering, Ezra, Nehemiah, and then Chronicles are the very last book in all of their scriptures. Why? Why would the Jewish people tell their story in this way? What difference does it even make? Well, think about the way that we talk about movie spoilers. How often do we ask someone not to tell us the end of a movie? Knowing the end in advance changes the experience, and often we believe it ruins the experience as you are watching everything that comes before it, but knowing what's coming. Many of you have heard me tell this story before, and Jane gave me permission to share it again because it feels so relevant here. Jane and I went to see the movie The Alamo together. Remember The Alamo? Well, Jane and I had two completely different experiences in the theater that day. I remembered how it ended. Jane did not. And it was truly one of the great moments in our marriage when, one by one, each of the main characters were dying off. And Jane leans over to me in the theater and whispers, "We win, right?" It was an honest mistake. History isn't exactly Jane's favorite subject, which she would admit. But you can imagine how different our two experiences in that theater were. Not knowing the end meant that the movie was actually much more emotionally intense as an experience for Jane. Like watching a thriller where you're sitting on the edge of your seat because you don't know what's coming. Whereas for me, there was a bit of an emotional detachment. I noticed myself trying not to get too wrapped up in the characters because I knew they were all going to die, because I knew what was going to happen. I could focus on other things than the plot. I could think about the meaning of the story in a different way. Which brings us back to the question, why would the Jewish people order their scriptures in the way that they did, giving away the ending in Ezra and Nehemiah before telling the rest of the story found in Chronicles. Answering this question will make us better readers of the Bible. Also, answering this question will help us know what to do specifically with this passage that we are looking at today. See, in 2 Chronicles chapters 29 through 32, we learn about the reign of King Hezekiah. Chapter 30, verse 26, summarizes his reign like this. So there was great joy in Jerusalem. For since the time of Solomon, the son of David, king of Israel, there had been nothing like this in Jerusalem. And then at the end of chapter 31, we get this amazing additional summary. Verse 20 says it like this. Thus Hezekiah did throughout all Judah, and he did what was good and right and faithful before the Lord his God. And every work that he undertook in the service of the house of God and in accordance with the law and the commandments, seeking his God, he did with all his heart and prospered. Hezekiah was a man among boys, a surprising king after a long string of huge letdowns. God's people could not have been further from their God when Hezekiah took the throne from his father Ahaz. But then for 29 years, Hezekiah did what was good and right and faithful. And so the temptation we have when we read this story is to start to make a list of accomplishments that Hezekiah achieves and then try to imitate him. We read Hezekiah as a script that offers us this formula for success, for a strategy for revival. If we just do all of the things that Hezekiah did, then we will restore the kingdom of God, and then everything will be good and right. This is our default way of reading the people we identify as heroes throughout the First Testament. But there's a problem. If you have read Ezra and Nehemiah before Chronicles, then you already know how the story goes, and this changes dramatically the way you hear Hezekiah's story and your sense of what is possible. It's like watching episodes 1, 2, and 3 of Star Wars. If you've already seen, as most people have when they see these, the original trilogy, right? And so you already know that Anakin Skywalker becomes Darth Vader. And so it changes the way that you invest yourself in Anakin's story. If you don't watch young Anakin hoping he doesn't turn to the dark side, because you already know that he does. Instead, you watch him wondering how and why it happened. If you're reading 2 Chronicles chapters 29 through 32, the story about King Hezekiah, this great reformer, and you're tempted to be inspired and to look to Hezekiah for clues about how to lead God's people in revival, Ezra and Nehemiah are the perfect wet blanket designed perfectly to dampen our inspired revivalism. Now, I know that we haven't together gotten to these books yet, and so you actually may not be familiar with them at all, but let me give you just a quick glimpse as to what they'll offer us when we get there later this year. They take place 150 years after Hezekiah, and they lay out the plain and ugly truth. Everything Hezekiah accomplishes in these four incredible chapters of reformation and revival is basically for nothing. That over time, and not that much time, it all gets destroyed. Within a few generations, all that's left are a few people trying to rebuild a lost dream, trying to reclaim some future glory. Ezra and Nehemiah warn us before reading Chronicles, essentially saying, listen, we know that you're gonna get excited when you read about kings like Hezekiah, but just settle down, take a breath. The best efforts of the best kings are all for nothing. Reading Ezra and Nehemiah helps keep us from thinking that we can simply imitate Hezekiah to lead God's people into a better future and there everything will be better. If you think that this is a little bit pessimistic, just wait, because Ezra and Nehemiah actually have one more brutal feature. Together, they tell the story of what it looks like when the kingdom is being reestablished. The people who had been exiled have now returned to the land. The temple that has been destroyed is now being rebuilt. The city of Jerusalem that was flattened is alive and it's secure. But three distinct times throughout Ezra and Nehemiah, we're left with this haunting question. Has anything actually changed for these people? And twice, the authors of Ezra and Nehemiah actually explicitly declare, no, nothing has changed. The people of Israel, they might be back in the land after a time of exile, but they are still living in slavery. In this way, Ezra and Nehemiah, they remind me of one of the demotivational posters that I shared with you earlier this year. It's the one, it's got a guy hunched over on a bench, towel over his head. He's clearly just finished a track race of some sort and lost. And the poster says, failure. Sometimes your best just isn't good enough. Ouch. It's dark. Real dark, but also it's true. The people of God had recovered so much of what they had lost previously. They had regained the appearance of some of their former greatness. In some ways, the only thing left to do was to put a son of David on the throne to restore Israel as a kingdom once and for all. But Ezra and Nehemiah declare, your best just isn't good enough. Like, you've rebuilt all of this stuff, and yet none of it has set you free from your slavery. And then Chronicles comes along and it declares the same. Your best just isn't good enough. It doesn't matter if it's David or Solomon or Hezekiah or Josiah. Your very best kings cannot make you free and they cannot keep you free. At least not forever. It's the Alamo. There are no survivors. It's the way Star Wars Episode 3 ends. Anakin Skywalker becomes Darth Vader. There's no way to escape it. Your best just isn't good enough. This is how the Jewish scriptures come to an end. Remember, Ezra, Nehemiah, and Chronicles finish their scriptures, put in this order on purpose by Israel's scribes. So that as you and I read the story of Hezekiah's dramatic reformation of Israel, we should have no confusion. Listen, you don't get any better than King Hezekiah, and yet Hezekiah is not enough to save you. What Israel needs, what the world needs, is another mighty act of God. An act of Exodus-sized proportions. Israel needs the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob to show up again in power and in glory if there is any hope for a kingdom. This, my brothers and sisters, is the gospel. That in Jesus, the God of Israel has come in the flesh to restore his kingdom with glory and power. But this time, not to conquer the Egypts and Babylons and Romes and Germanys and Americas of the world. God has already proven his ability to humble every arrogant empire. At this point, the scriptures are pretty clear. This is kind of an easy job for him. No. The good news is that Jesus has come to demonstrate a more beautiful glory and a greater power and an unshakable kingdom. The radiant glory of our God is seen most clearly on the cross as the creator of heaven and earth hangs crucified, a bloody mess, bearing the sins of the world, offering forgiveness for those who know not what they do, suffering for your sins and for mine, motivated by a love more powerful than anything, including any fear of death. Jesus shows himself to be a king unlike any other. His glory seen on the cross. See, one of the defining moments during Hezekiah's reign was his effort to lead all Israel, both southern and northern kingdoms, to celebrate the Passover once again. It had been generations since God's people had last celebrated the Passover. And chapter 30 tells us about this epic unifying moment for both northern and southern kingdoms. And we're told that the people were filled with gladness. The people lifted their voice in praise and they sang with all of their might to the Lord because of this celebration. And something happens when you remember the moment of your salvation. And Hezekiah brings God's people back to that moment when they experienced God's saving hand. They needed to remember who they were and whose they were. But we learn from the story, the Passover isn't enough to sustain the Israelites forever. See, it's too easy to forget what God has done when you celebrate one time a year. It's too easy to forget why you were bringing a lamb to the temple each year. And it was too easy for the next king to simply stop everyone from celebrating the Passover. And so the gospel tells us that Jesus steps into Hezekiah's role to remind the people who they are and whose they are, that they are loved and belong to the Father. Jesus is the king who has come to restore his kingdom, to gather his sheep. And he does this by leading his people to celebrate the truest Passover. As he does this, Jesus changes the Passover forever. He takes the bread and he announces that it is his own body. He takes the cup and he announces that it is his own blood. And then Jesus suffers the death of the firstborn. And it is by his death that Jesus becomes our Passover. We don't simply try to remember this thing that Jesus did a long time ago, this mighty act of God that God did sometime in the past. We have been brought into relationship, consistent and constant conversation with the one who is even today our Passover. Jesus is the king who suffers and dies for his very own citizens. Something neither David, nor Solomon, nor Hezekiah, nor Josiah were ever ready to do. Jesus was lifted up on his throne, exalted, glorified, a throne found in the form of a cross. But if King Jesus can die, we're left with this question: what makes him any different than David or Solomon or Hezekiah or Josiah? What good is a king who dies like everybody else? Well, as the gospel proclaims, and as our creed declares, on the third day, he rose again. This is the power of God at work in the world. Israel had seen firsthand again and again the power of God. They had seen it in the plagues of Egypt. They'd seen it in the pillar of smoke and fire through the wilderness. They had seen it in the parting of the Red Sea and in the gift of daily bread and water as God led them through the wilderness and on and on and on throughout their history. Israel even shared stories of moments when God reached into the grave to raise someone from the dead. But each time someone was raised to new life, these people were raised only to die again until Jesus raised in a completely new and everlasting form. God, in that moment, demonstrates his power definitively and decisively, once and for all, that death can no longer undo God's creation permanently. Death's stinger has been removed, because while we still face our own deaths, we do so with the promise that comes with the resurrection of Jesus, that what God did for Jesus, he will one day do for us that day when he returns, when all things are made new. Jesus, the King of heaven and earth, is alive. Right now, he reigns. This is why, when we read Chronicles, we have no need to imitate Hezekiah, and we have no need to find a new Hezekiah. We don't need to find the right or the perfect leader to rule over us. We're done playing the roller coaster game of guess whether this leader is going to be good or this one's going to be bad. And we don't play the games of the kingdoms of the world who keep trying to find the best leader who will lead their people into salvation. We don't need any of that, because our citizenship is found in an unshakable kingdom. We already have our good and faithful and righteous king. And his reign will never end. We don't need another Hezekiah. The world is already being ruled by the King of Kings and Lord of Lords. Do you believe that? And today he is inviting us as his citizens to submit our lives to him fully. You may have noticed at this point in my sermon that I've said very little about Hezekiah or chapters 29 through 32 of 2 Chronicles, except to just say that Hezekiah's reign was amazing and that he was this great reformer and he did a number of things that were incredible. It's on purpose that I haven't said much. With everything I've told you, I've been trying to give you a way of reading, tools for reading, a framework to help you meditate on this passage for yourself. I want you to go and read it again. Actually, I want you to go and I want you to read it with at least one other person, hopefully multiple people. And I want you to read it with Jesus in your mind. The story of Jesus. How does Jesus fulfill all of the hopes and the dreams that Hezekiah stirs up, and then even more so. If we are to think of Hezekiah as a shadow that leads us to the real and true King, in what ways do we see Jesus fulfilling this hope found in Hezekiah? And there are at least three big categories I want you to consider. And I've already given you a little bit of work with the third category. But beyond these three, you might notice some other categories where Hezekiah helps prepare us to see and hear who Jesus is and what Jesus is doing so that we might follow him more fully. So here are the three categories. First, what does Hezekiah do to restore the priests of Israel to their God-given work? What does Hezekiah do to restore the priests of Israel to their God-given work? Second, what does Hezekiah do to restore the house of God? Third, what does Hezekiah do to restore the Passover celebration? The links to Jesus are pretty straightforward then. As God's true King, what does Jesus do to restore you and me as individuals to our God-given priestly vocation? You were made to be a priest. How does Jesus restore you to that work? What is he calling you into to fulfill and carry it out? Second, as God's true King, what is Jesus doing to build us, not as individuals, us collectively into a holy dwelling place for God? What is God doing? What is Jesus doing to make us into a family, the house of God? What is Jesus doing to restore us as a dwelling place for God? And finally, as God's true King, what is Jesus doing to bring Passover celebration to the center of our lives? In what ways is the Passover, is Jesus as our Passover, constantly taking center stage, reorienting all of our lives, inviting us to live as free people who have been drawn into this new kingdom and new way of life? I hope that you can see the connections. The best that Hezekiah could ever do as a king was imitate his father David, who himself was a flawed king. Which meant the best that Hezekiah's people could ever do was follow the lead of a guy imitating a flawed ancestor. And that was the best that they could hope for. But Jesus has come. And we're told that in every possible way, Jesus did nothing but the will of his Father in heaven. And he calls us to trust in him as our King, to submit our lives to his rule and reign, to pray for the will of the Father to be done in our lives. And he calls us to follow him wherever he goes, taking up crosses daily. We have a King who is good and who is faithful and is righteous. Today, we have the choice to live as citizens of his kingdom, to seek him, to draw near to him, to imitate him. And I am praying for you as you reread this passage, hopefully with some others, that you can see the glory of King Jesus on the cross, that you might experience the resurrection power of King Jesus, who is raised from the dead, and that the kingdom of God is calling to you and inviting you to come and serve and love your King, would be heard and would move you to action today and this week. I'm praying for you. Would you pray for me as I do the same? Grace and peace, friend.